the way you filmed it, was that a white lens or something you used the whole time?
I used a lot Stanley Kubrick's favourite lens, the 18mm. Early on in my career, the first director of photography I worked with was a guy called Larry Smith, who had done Eyes Wide Shut for Kubrick, and previously had been gaffer or best boy on The Shining, and worked for Stanley for years and years. And so I learned a lot through him about the way Stanley likes to work. And Stanley, you know, almost some movies shoot almost exclusively on the 18. And I chose it for this film because I liked the way it means people are always in relationship to their space. You know, if you shoot a traditional Hollywood close-up on a mid to long length lens, it's a face against mush, out of focus mush. Whereas this pulls the world right into you. And therefore people are always framed in an architecture or an environment, and I was very interested in faces in relation to negative space here. So for example, Colin against that shot blasted wall of the consulting room, it seemed to say more about his psychology than Colin against a soft colourful mush. But it was also, I just had a feeling that I wanted to be incredibly intimate and close with the actors, and when you're shooting like that, I mean, the camera was kind of, you know, it's kind of there, and it's quite tough on an actor, but I operate myself on those kind of setups, and so I'm right there and the actor's right there, and there's a strong sense of, you know, very exposed scrutiny that happens when the camera's that close, which I think, you know, on performances is kind of interesting because it's very exposing.
And the intimacy certainly comes across. That's what as soon as I walked out of there, I said I love the way you shot it, because I felt like it's rare that you feel like you get to know characters as well as you do in this film.
I mean, we had a great test day where, you know, Jeffrey and Colin and I shot them from different angles, different lenses, and I just studied their face and studied the way I wanted to, you know, and just explored it. But it's an unusual way to shoot close to this day.
Well, intimacy comes across in the way you shot it, and also obviously the performances. You really feel like you get to know these people. I think a lot of that has to do with your chemistry with Jeffrey. Had you worked together on anything previously? Did you know each other well?
We knew each other, but not. We hadn't really worked together. We were both in Shakespeare in Love, but we were.
Did you act much to that?
I think there was a couple of scenes where we might have passed in a corridor.
Yeah, was the chemistry good then?
No. I'll tell you when we were together. One of my favourite lines in Shakespeare in Love, and it was just bliss, because I think it was just from actor to actor. Yeah. It was about billing. And it was, there's a scene, I have a sword fight at the end of Shakespeare, and someone says, stop, he didn't kill Marlowe, Marlowe was killed by somebody else in a bar, there was an argument over the bill. And Jeffrey's line is, bill, vanity.
Yeah.
It was not the billing, the bill. And I was in that room with him when he did that. Now, Jeffrey and I got to know each other while we publicised the film, which is often what happens, because filming is just work. And unless the work kind of informs the relationship, in this case, it's certainly, you don't... It's not playtime, you know, so you don't necessarily develop a friendship. I think something very special happens when you do that. But it was when we were sort of boys together in New York the following year when the film came out. When I got to know Jeffrey a bit. And, you know, he was showered with attention for that.
Sure.
Yeah. And we were able to shoot their consulting, I mean, their main spine of their movie, actually pretty much in chronology. So, as I think I said it afterwards, that the first day of the shoot we did the first consulting room scene, and it's the first time they've met. And although, you know, yes, we've been rehearsing for 3 weeks, it was the first time they've met on camera. And I think some of that sense of it's the first day for all of us, it's their first day, right. It's their first being on camera, it helped to give that kind of quality.
Well, it was, I think that is true to a very, very particular extent in this film. I mean, I've often started a job, you know, where the first day is a walk down the corridor and look out of a window. And you feel that the things sort of are being held at bay from you for a while, and you're not sure what you're committing to. I mean, I did a film once when actually weeks went by before I got into the meat of it, and I began to lose connection with it and not wonder. I knew this thing was taking place, and I had no foothold. This, on the other hand, couldn't have been more different. It wasn't only that we started with a central scene. I mean, mean, one of probably one of the standout
scenes in the film.
Scenes in the film, sure. In terms of its importance and everything else, was our first scene together.
Right.
Not only that, Tom started with a shot that was pretty. Had a way of committing it.
Yes,
well.
Yeah.
He didn't start with a big master shot of the room. It wasn't a close up, but it was
a shot of him hunkered down in the bottom left of frame.
With that a single meal show frame.
Yeah.
Which meant that I'm up now. Mm. You know, I'm not going to sort of find my way via this is how I walk into the room.
Right.
I can mess it up a little bit here and then finesse it in the close up. Mm-hmm. This is it, I'm off. Mm-hmm. And once we did that one take, I felt we'd set the
set. Yeah.
Hi there.
Hello.
Chris.
Oh. Yeah, good to see you.
Nice to see you.
And Tom said at the end of that day, I don't know what the exact percentage was, but he said something like, well, I think we just shot 10% of the film.
I know.
Oh, you know, when once we'd done two of the big interview scenes, yeah. We went, well, there's 40 pages.
Well, the way you calculate time and how much space is taken up on a script, I mean, there's a rough way of doing it. But there's some famous stage direction. He gets on a horse and rides away, which takes on 2 weeks to shoot when you've got the extra waiting for the weather. Eight pages of dialogue with two people sitting in the same spot can be done quite quickly.
Mm-hmm. The fact that was the first time they were on screen together, was that by design in the schedule?
Yeah.
Yeah? That's how you wanted to do it? Well, that certainly comes across.
We'd spent 3 weeks in pretty serious script analysis, developments. We've just received the diaries and we're trying to incorporate some really fascinating ideas that were in them that were alluded to in the screenplay, concrete. And Tom's hallmark, I think, is seeing John Adams. He just kept going up. Why fabricate a melodramatic narrative drive when the real facts are actually that much more interesting?
Right, exactly.
You know.
That must have been a treasure trove to come across.
And the thing, I'm just the missing link in the story. You know, when I introduced the film, I told the story of David writing to the Greek mother.
Right.
He was writing because he wanted to read those papers. Mm. And he'd found Ballantyne, who was a son of Logue, and Ballantyne Logue, who's Lionel's son, said, "Oh, well, you know, write to the Queen Mum, and then I'll let you look at the papers." Because the Queen Mum said that, he didn't have access to the papers. So us getting those papers finally after all these, you know, having the Logue family saying yes, you can read it, was great because it was something that we waited for. And I think when David wrote down to write, sat down to write the script, he'd lost contact and couldn't find the Logues anymore, so he had to write the script without access to them. Fantastic, just in the nick of time, we finally found it.
Now, when the two of you were promoting Shakespeare in Love, did you, and developed a friendship, did you want to kind of find a project one of these days to work together on?
We didn't know each other that well.
No?
We just had fun.
We met on the junket, really.
Yeah, that's right.
I remember we were in New York. And we went to that club called The Cub. Cub Bar downtown.
It wasn't just the two of us either. I mean, it was Wilkinson and...
Yeah. And Rupert Everett.
Rupert,
it was a dangerous group.
Rupert out there?
Yeah. That's where that was the only time I met him.
God.
No,
yeah, we had fun. He was a party boy. Wouldn't let me go to bed.
So the script came to them separately, I suppose, and
very separately.
Yeah. Well, tell us. Tell the story of how you got the script. Is it extraordinary?
I got the. It's happened to me once or twice, where you get the brown paper script somehow delivered. In my case, to my front door at my residence in Camberwell in Melbourne, the cover note going, "Please forgive the unorthodoxy of delivering this to you, not by your agent, but we are the Wild Time production company, and here is a play called The King's Speech, and we're interested in mounting it." And they had a wish list cast. I wish I should have dug that out.
Yeah.
Which I think I wasn't on.
Lionel Logue was me, but then Bertie, they had Ray Fiennes and a number of names, and they were looking at a wish list. And I read it, and I thought...
And this was just a stage play,
right?
Yeah, and I just thought, well, this would be 5 months out of my life. It's not going to work with my family, my table, whatever. And there was also a DVD with it of a staged informal reading which had a slightly quasi Shakespearean dimension to it, and I just thought, no, this is not for me. But I think there's a brilliant film in it, because the scenes between Logue and Bertie as a stage play just seemed to be swamped by, there were so many other scenes with the Archbishop and Baldwin, and you know, they were trying to do Henry V.
Sure.
And there were just a lot of big talky scenes, and I went, oh, this has got all that pomp and pageantry. But these scenes between these two guys filmed seem to me to be very small. So I got under my agent and said, look, please give them a polite decline, but I don't choose to do that. But I think there's a film script. And in the meantime, Tom's parents had been at that stage reading, and they said to him,
so I thought they were to do the story correctly. So I'm, the only way I knew about this production is because I'm half Australian. Because my Australian mum, who lives in London, was invited by some Australian friends to a fringe theatre play reading of this unproduced play, having never been invited to a play reading in her life.
And written by David at the time.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. And they were like, you know, we need some Aussies in the audience, will you come along? So she went along. She called me up and said, I've just seen this play reading, and I think I might have found your next film. And I was like, thanks, Mum. Have the writer send it to me, I'm sure I'll read it. And, you know, so the script came, and it sat on my desk, and there were, you know, 30 scripts from my agents that I was told were, you know, fantastic. And so GGL was going through those, and this other script sat there. And, you know, every 2 or 3 weeks, my mum would go, have you read it? And kind of give me a gentle nag. And I go, yeah, well, and after probably too long, I mean, maybe even 3 or 4 months, I finally read it in one sitting, rang her up me, and he said, I'm so sorry, you're absolutely right, it is my next movie. So, you know, Jeffrey gets the script posted through his letterbox completely unsolicited. I find it out because my mum happens to be in Australia. And what I love is when, you know, we're all told that the system that would get us the material works. And it's great when you find great material that is, you know, doesn't come through the system.
Right.
And David had written it. I mean, when he first wanted to write it as a film, but when he sat down to write it, he found, he actually wrote it as a stage play, as an exercise, but he was getting a bit blocked, so he thought it'll be simpler as a play, so let me write it like that. And then someone read it and said, oh, it'd make a great play, and so that kind of took on a life of its own, and that was when we all came about. And so, you know, by the time I got in touch with David Seidel, I was doing John Adams at the time, so I was pretty busy. He then told me that Jeffrey was interested, and there was a producer in Canning who'd already, got an option on the material, and so it came together pretty fast. And then, you know, the only bit of conventional, the only conventional thing in the story is how Colin Firth came.
Colin
Firth, I kind of sat
the third part,
cast.
The third
and,
part
and
of that jigsaw.
That's a Colin Firth.
That's me. Were you going to do it? Yes.
Yeah. The third part of that jigsaw.
We
and I had sat next to each other as accidental dinner guests in 2005. Is that when you were promoting Elizabeth I?
Yeah, I was
Colin Callender from HBO, and I'd worked with him on the Peter Sellers film. He said, oh, Jeffrey, you're at the Chateau. I've got Jeremy Irons and a guy called Tom Cooper, Callender, and we're having a big HBO dinner. Would you please come and join us? Because we're going through that whole thing that we went through last year with Sellers. And I got sat next to him, and we just spent the whole night rabbiting on and having a grand old time. So when I knew that Tom Hooper was out to do it, I went, oh, that guy.
Okay.
I'd be completely wrong for it. No. So it was all very haphazard. And
But it came together quick. I mean, his films it was smooth.
And he, you know, we were doing, I don't know, I'll have to go back to my emails, but in speculative casting, my wife read it, because she's always my sounding board, and she said, Douglas, this is Colin Firth. I said, yeah, I think you're right. And then there was, I don't know, lack of availability or something. What were you doing late 2008? It was around about that time. And then people started to bandy around names, and I went, no, you can't have an American playing George VI. You know, and people will always say to me, yeah, but you played Trotsky, who's Russian, or you know what I mean?
Sure.
I said, and we had this conversation, I said, look, there's a quintessential Anglo-Australian conflict. that is its own thing.
Which is Tom.
And it has to be. Yeah, yeah. He is basically Bertie slash Lowe.
He is that dynamic.
True. You are. We've both based our performances on a kind of
hybrid of me.
Yeah, a split personality.
I grew up with an Australian mum and an English father, and my English father had lost his father in the war at the age of 3, and had gone to full-time boarding school at the age of 5, and had, you know, one of those very, very brutal English traditional upbringings. And the story of my childhood was my Australian mother unpacking, I suppose, you know, some of the damage done to my dad by that upbringing. And in a way, this story, you know, that childhood story is this story, because this is, you know, an Australian unpacking the damage done to an English king.
I'm a failed Shakespearean actor, and you stand up through quite a few romantic comedies.
What could be more perfect?
Exactly. Lifetime of stammering.
The weird thing is, I didn't see that. I got the Anglo-Australian thing in relation to me, but I never realised how it related to my own childhood until I finished the film and I was suddenly talking about it, and I suddenly thought, oh my god, this feels very familiar to me.
So then that wasn't an undercurrent while you were filming it?
Oh, it was, but it was an undercurrent. Sometimes you're talking about something close to you without even kind of realising how close it is. And so in a weird way, I think it's the most personal piece of work I've ever done, because it doesn't appear that it could be, because it's about historic, you know,
history. Regarding stammering, you know, you get dialogue coaches from time to time. Was there a speech impediment coach employed for something like that?
No.
No?
That was a fantastically good actor.
Now, your sister came up with a couple of...
We got some advice, though.
Yeah, I'm just curious how that came to be.
Yeah. There was a key figure who had nothing to do with the stammering, who was Neil. Neil Swain was much more to do with putting us... Putting us on the calendar in terms of how people spoke then, people with that class. Because, it's true of North America too. If you listen to recordings of people in the 1930s, there's a different pace, there's a different timbre to everything. Sometimes there was this quite a mid-Atlantic sound. You know, you listen to, you know, everybody talking on the phone like this, and the Americans, you know, you thought he'd double cross me, he's never going to get away with it. And the English are all, you know, the Cockneys are all talking like that. Yeah, flick it, blog it, blimey, come there.
Yeah.
And I don't know if people really know that was movie speak, but if you hear the royalty, I mean, it has almost become an entirely different dialect.
Yeah.
But the same class of people speak now than they did of that generation. My grandfather used to roll his R's in terms of terribly, terribly good. And we had to sort of rediscover a bit of that. My character also has the weak R. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Bertie is the
right.
Which, having listened to lots of recordings, is quite common to this class. So there was that, and Neil's more to do with that. He didn't really concentrate on stammer. That was sort of up to us to discover.
Right. I mean, in the end, I think it was the footage of Bertie himself.
It was Bertie himself. Yeah. I mean, Tom and I had the question about what form does it take? There's the version which is the road repetition, you know, and this is more of a block. And it struck me from just from looking at film of Bertie, which is almost all post therapy. So we don't really have any record of what he must have been like before he met Lowe. They seem more like long pauses than anything else.
Right.
But you do hear that little sound in the throat. You do hear that catch. You do hear the attempt to get a consonant out.
How about that?
And
1925
muscles here. Yeah.
You see the muscles going.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
How about the speech from 1925? Is that?
That's not. There's no audio. Audio recording of it.
Oh really? Okay.
And there's some shots, some fleeting shots of him going up there. But
we have reports.
We have reports of it being a complete disaster.
I see.
I mean, we take a glimpse of a moment of it. I have no idea whether.
And radio then was literally two years old in Britain.
But the telling sign is when you look at the footage, he goes, you know, he comes in, he goes past the soldiers, he goes up the steps, he gets to the microphone, and then he cuts, and then he goes down. And they don't have any of them at the microphone.
There's various footage of various speeches, and they're very tellingly clumsy cutaways. Arbitrary, to a chimney. He's talking, he's suddenly looking at a chimney.
Come back to
and then your sister was
My sister was probably in terms of
of therapy and of what the obstacles are and how you solve them. Because actors are always doing a thing which is completely conflicted. You have to do a complete two-way counterintuitive exercise. You have to try to do something, then conceal that you're trying to do that, and play the character trying not to do that. I mean, an angry person. I mean, obviously, starting from scratch, the actor has to achieve anger. So that's your initial effort. But most angry people are trying to control their anger, or they're trying to channel their anger. So then your job becomes simply the management of the thing that you found. Stuttering was like, I have to try not to stutter.
But David Sidler himself gave us a lot of insights from his own experience.
Yes.
He said you would just hit this self-perpetuating loop where if people knew you were studying or undergoing any form of therapy, socially you'd be out there going, well, I've learned a few techniques to get myself through. Now everyone's looking at me, waiting for me to be abnormal. And the mind game, you know what I mean?
And then that becomes self-fulfilling, as you say.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But he wants to say you would end up ordering something different because you don't want to say the word that the thing you want. If you have trouble with F, you decide not to have the fish. You're just going to go for the steak.
That's right.
You know, and you say you're actually, you know, you're getting yourself around things. You're saying things you don't really want to say. And actually, he said, and this was very useful to me. He said, it is all you think about.
It's what?
All you think about. It's all you think about in terms of if I have to go out for dinner tonight, or if I have to say something, or I have to go to class. You will not think past that. You don't care about anything other than will I get.
He would never say hello on the phone. He always would say, it's David here, because he could get that out rather than.
And also, I think, as I said in the Q&A, Bertie didn't have a single word he was written. S was probably what seemed to me the one that came easiest to me.
Mm.
And R, didn't seem to stutter on that. But actually, even on S, I noticed, I think, every letter of the alphabet gave me a problem. W seemed to be the very worst. Which is odd, because you would imagine it could be either from a glottal thing or a consonant.
Mm-hmm.
So I used it, but my sister is a voice therapist. Not a speech therapist, a voice therapist. And she specializes in dealing with the psychology as it's related to speech. So it doesn't have to be about impediments, so to speak. It can be about people feeling compromised by how they come across. I mean, the doctor saying, I think I'm aggressive. I don't feel aggressive.
So psychology is very much what Lionel was trying to get at.
He's kind of psychoanalyzing by stealth.
Yeah.
You know, just give him a brandy and just see if we can draw something out.
Yeah.
Right. And that was a very progressive way of thinking at the time.
Yeah.
You know, it goes back to regeneration, and if you read those books, William Rivers, a great
doctor. Rivers, that's the
same right. Generation, First World War veteran. And a lot of people are out there saying, well, just give them electric shocks or aversion therapy or frighten them or bully them.
Yeah, yeah.
And Rivers said, I think if we can connect them to the source and get them to express what happened to them,
right. That
maybe that's a path to healing. And he was considered wacky. And
I found that first interview today, I've forgotten some of those exchanges where he just says, I've had it all my life and it's incurable. And that was the belief.
That would be one of the hard things. Well, the hardest things to achieve, and I'm not at one level. It's never been fully achieved. Is to somehow get back to that point where the talking cure was radical, dangerous stuff. You know, the idea that you could help him. We talk about his personal life. Was ridiculous.
Inappropriate, unseemly.
Right. And of course, now we're all schooled in films where, you know, everyone confesses everything to each other.
Our running joke on set was embracing each other and going, it's not your fault. But I actually think, I mean, beyond all that, one can talk about the beautiful gauging that Collins created in the arc of the character. I actually think it's a dramatic metaphor for people. This is why I think people connect with the movie. It's the flaw in the character is. I don't have an inability to speak publicly or express my thoughts, but I've got other anxieties about self-presentation.
Yeah, things I think I can't do. I can't. I can't fulfill my job. I can't fulfill my my marriage.
I can't do karaoke. You know, you get a group of people.
I can't play.
Out of
I can't
10
do
people,
public speaking.
Two people, three in the karaoke, and everyone else goes, "Oh, I'll, in a moment when I've had about eight vodkas." You know what I mean?
It's broader than overcoming disability. It's overcoming any kind of impediment that you might feel to being yourself in the way you want to be yourself in public.
And we love the fact that the brutality of the terminology from the era was defects.
Defects was an acceptable word. Four Texan women came past today just seeing the speech. And they were beside themselves. And that was when I realised that we were sort of okay in terms of, I don't think this is niche.
It's not.
No. Four Texan women. Lovely ladies of a certain age. And kind of had taken it to heart. Absolutely waxing lyrical.
Was that kind of thing apparent in the screenplay from the beginning, or did you work that in with receiving things like the diaries and stuff like that to pump up the thematics?
I think it deepened and got many more grace notes and many more kind of subtleties.
But also getting to know who these people were, because I mean, a script is a series of clues, and sometimes it's brilliantly written, they resonate tremendously, and if you're very lucky, they chime with something that's, I don't know, just it happens very quickly, there's just something in you there's a chemical reaction of some sort.
See, Helena came into those early 3 weeks of development and script analysis. And I don't know the full history of this, and you might be able to embroider it. But on one side of her family, there were connections with ladies in waiting who had worked at the palace, I think. Yeah. And she said, look, you know, the obvious, you know, actors are always looking to avoid the cliches. And she said, I can't play Elizabeth, who, like we all know, is the Queen Mother, as this snooty person, because everything I know about that world is that there was this amazing grace, charm, authority, and putting people at ease in a very formal way. It wasn't like, oh, I'm sniffy and snotty and can't really cope talking.
Right. She was a great specialist.
And that had added a tremendous amount.
She had a gift for that.
Yeah, yeah. But it added a lot to
what it seemed. Sometimes what seems like detail
made the chess
game unlock a lot of information. I mean, I read a lot of books around it, and some are more reliable than others, and a lot of gossip and tattle and whatever. And sometimes there were letters written by our characters. A diary, some of it was just reported stuff. But there are tremendous clues in that stuff. And one of them was to do with the splints on the legs. Do you remember the reference to the fact he had no legs? That his... I'm forgetting my research now, but whoever it was who looked after him, was he some sort of manservant, valet, who Bertie became quite attached to, took the legs off one night, the splints off the legs. For him to sleep, he had to wear them to sleep as well. They hurt like crazy. Yeah. And he just felt such sympathy for the agony that this boy was going through to sleep. He was about eight. And it was a real gift to do that. And the father found out about it, of course, Smith found out about it the next day, and he had tremendous dressing down, lifted off his kilt and said, you want to end up with legs like these?
Right.
The guy nearly lost his
job. A goon's moment.
Yes. Little punch in the name.
I love your movie.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I mean, I think.
But I think you got cheated out of single man.
Oh, thank you. Bless you.
We're going to have another shot.
I saw it twice. I went to see it again after the awards.
Oh. Well, that's good very time. Kind. Thank you. I need to say that's an interesting story. It meant he had a bad day once. But what it meant to me wasn't about the legs and the splints. It was who was looking after him.
Exactly, the care.
It wasn't his mom who came up and took the splints off. And it wasn't his dad. It wasn't even the nanny.
That was the most heartbreaking moment when you sing that moment about not feeding you. That was really tough.
That is true. I mean, that is absolutely documented. This woman was for 3 years, she did not feed him adequately.
But when we worked on that scene, Colin said, you know, but I don't want to play, I don't want to fall into a kind of self-pitying sentimentality.
Very worrying, that actually.
But there were those little beats in the script that went, but I'm all right now. That's how it happened.
Well, it was very important that I had to find a way to
pull myself out.
There's a very thin line. Do you want a precipice of something?
A wine or something?
But there's a bit, but I mean, in answer to your
question, you have.
Yeah, I have whatever you have to. Yeah.
Chardonnay?
Yeah, a glass of wine's fine. Thank you.
But in my answer to your question about how much it developed, it developed all the time. I mean, even in the cutting room, we were still finding it. And I think the thing that took longest to develop was, in the end, I felt that what saved him was the friendship between the two men. And I think when that wasn't really in the script, that wasn't in the script, and it possibly wasn't even entirely clear from the first cut. But I just, the more we worked, the more I began to think, no, because he's not, at the end, he doesn't lose his stamina, at the end, he's not cured. And what helps him in that moment do it? So it's about the same to his friend. And what I loved about the process is, you know, like, I know I talked about it on today, but is it because of working with these two guys, you could kind of, I could ring Jeffrey up in Australia and just kind of go, after we finish shooting, and just go, this is what I feel the film saying, but how do we set better? Or, you know, and it was a wonderful organic process that just kept going, and it felt like it took a long time to get to that trip. But like, that is the metaphor.
Did you ever feel it's attempting to not fitting?
No, never, because specifically with that moment, just to be able as an actor to sing it as part of the narrative kind of pulls back on that kind of falling in to a certain kind of
it place. Becomes part of the game about the shilling bit, will I sing, won't I sing,
well,
yes I will sing, but
there's an Englishness in that. There's a device that protects you from it, which is, it's just self-awareness. Mm-hmm. Whatever you're talking about, there's a wryness that accompanies that is what I hope was the tool that would save it from that.
Right.
You know, because a lot of the stuff that was being said, I mean, these tales are but, you know, as long as there was a way to say I'm detached enough from what I'm telling you, for there either to be some wit or playfulness or reflectiveness that accompanies it, so that I'm not just opening my veins.
Right. No, I think it's very balanced.
But it's, you know, it's in the real character of Bertie, and it was in Sideley's writing. Very much it.
Just when it, like, our food is starting to arrive.
Oh, great.
So thank you.
Wrap it up.
Nice to meet you.
You as well. Get you the film, and good luck with it throughout the season.
See,
those conversations, I think as actors, we both looked at Tom and went, this is a 10, 12 page scene. Is this kind of all? Because that's going to be like 9 minutes.
And that's the kind of secret audacity of the movie. I mean, where do you get movies nowadays that have scenes like that?
And halfway through the shoot, they, you know, this is a pretty standard strategy when you're on freezing locations. Not that morale was going down, but I think halfway through the shoot, the editor put together a little 12-minute assembly of missing scenes as a sequence to show to everybody on the crew, which I didn't want to go and see because I didn't want to look at objectively what we were doing. I just would rather remember it from how we shot it. But someone from wardrobe or makeup came out and I said, what did you think? Really tell me what you thought. And she said, what about the scenes where we're interviewing? Do they hold? She said, that's the moment when you said to him, what's your first childhood memory? She suddenly went, oh my God, this is really interesting. Do you know what I mean? There was a mild electricity in there.
We're going to go somewhere.
We're going to go somewhere where George V and Queen Mary or no one else within that dysfunctional
family. They don't do
family.
That. And Bertie's reaction there isn't just, I'm not telling you, it's, what are you saying?
Yeah.
No one's ever.
But what Jeffrey was saying, meaning about the importance of having an Australian and an Englishman playing these two key roles. I mean, I think one of the reasons why Colin was so right for it is he wants an actor who's in an interesting dialogue with his own reserve. And Colin is one of those actors. And actually, even the way you talk now about your fear of self-pity, your fear, and so much of it is to do with your fear of doing too much. And it's a form of a discussion.
It's a constant wrestle between us, wasn't it?
And what's interesting is it's an acting version of, you know,
it parallels what the character is dealing with.
Yeah.
It's very interesting. I read a book once about a thesis about these six Shakespeare plays. It's called The Unnatural Scene. It's a fantastically penetrating study of how the experience of acting a Shakespearean, a major Shakespearean role,
has parallels with what the character endures. In other words, the character, the actor playing Hamlet, is often stricken with paralyzing possibility, infinite possibilities.
Oh, wow.
And you think, oh, it's endless. I mean, I could go all the way with this.
Yeah, totally.
This possibility is so tempting, and you end up sickly to over the pale cast of thought.
Yeah.
And then if the character's playing Lear, feel limited. The character's too big for me. I have this colossus. I have all this passion, but I feel so inadequate to express it. I feel it, but no one gets it.
But I used to try and drag him out of any kind of stutterer's morass by going, now let's look at the genre. We've got Billy Babbitt from Cookies. We were looking at the famous factory. We had Jacoby on set.
Jacoby's on the set, and like it helped.
You know, Claudius. I mean, there are a couple
of major. All right, here's an anecdote for you. I finally remembered an anecdote, and it's a short one.
Okay, good.
He put it. What was it? You put a 2-hour limit.
No, 2 minutes.
Oh, 2 minutes. Sorry,
rule on anecdote length during rehearsal, and a 30-second rule on anecdote length during the shoot. I imagine it can get out of hand.
And the fact that they were riveting, I thought they were very threatening to do this again.
Some of that was our own talking cure. We would suddenly stumble on things like, I think that's where we came up with the idea of, we would look at the script and say, there's something sticking in this scene. And I said, well, I'd start to paraphrase and say, well, really what he's saying is, this is not the most accurate example, but it's like, I'll bet you a shilling, or, you know, and we play with those gags to find, well, what would they really say? And we would find something more blunt.
I know what you mean. What would often happen, and I was a kind of gannet to catch them if I couldn't bottle them, but a lot of them take things that Jeffrey or Tom would just say.
Well, that's about a shilling's worth.
Yes.
I think that was
Tom would say something like, you know, it'd be like with Your Face is on the Shilling. That was a line you coined to the pub, but you came up with that without intending it to be the line, necessarily.
Yeah.
We would be discussing how does this guy express that my father's everywhere without having a scene going, oh, my father's everywhere.
Right.
How do you get a pithy way? And then Jeffrey might say, I know, it's like, you know, your face is, he's on this shilling you. And I was like, why can't that be the line? And that process happened quite a lot, that someone would paraphrase what they're trying to say. And we would think, actually, let that.
That was my favorite laugh today when you sat down
and said, here's the shilling.
Visiting, here's the shilling I need. And the audience were right on to that's the
game. That was, to me, the evidence they were in it completely.
Yeah.
I just want to ask one thing of you real quick. Regarding the photo, you said you found it was the only visual thing you had to go by. Other than, you said that, you know, he came across very dapper to you, but what did you pull out of that as far as your purposes? I'm very curious, because obviously you have the diaries, but regarding that specific visual.
Right.
And that'll be the last thing I'll let you guys go.
It was.
I want to hear the anecdote.
Oh, I forgot about the anecdote.
Come on.
Oh, no.
You're off the hook now.
It was an early discussion we had, and I said, I think we would really cheapen this story if we over-Australianized for an international audience what an Australian speech therapist might have been like in the 1930s if we make him like a
crocodile
Paul Hogan figure. Like, you know,
right.
we don't want to go, the Crocodile Dundee figure didn't really emerge till the 70s.
Sure.
And there would have been much more of an absorption in
also,
English
it would have been so reductive, because it would have been Royal versus Crocodile Dundee, rather than two.
And
men.
I said, I really feel it's a kind of attitude and an energy and an ability to stomp on stuffy orthodoxies of British culture just by a natural Australian sense of how you enter a room. You know, I mean, Peter Weir was talking about this the other night at his tribute, and he said, you know, after 40 years of a wasteland of Australian cinema. Suddenly these major voices just came out of nowhere. And he said, because we were all working class, there was really no middle class, and we all just felt we were the first generation to really go to universities or film school. And everyone felt we had the ability to cross class barriers that maybe didn't exist in Britain. You know, I mean, I was there in the 90s when, you know, I remember all the guys in Shakespeare in Love. I was so honored to be working with Barnaby and Bob Barrett and all these boys who were fiercely regional.
They
and
were.
It was the first
they
generation.
Were the
they were still Geordies, they were still Scottish, they were still Irish.
And, they'd
do their RP because they'd learned at drama school.
Stuff,
but unlike O'Toole and the generation
else.
Before, where they had all had to squash their origins.
Right.
So we played with that, and in the original idea, Lionel Logue was still an aspiring actor, and I basically said, look, by the time we shoot this film, I'm going to be 57. I don't think the audience is going to buy that he's still wanting
trying.
To do auditions. And we came up with the idea that he was a dilettante, and he loved doing regional London amateur productions, because he was a guy who would get up in pubs and do poems, and he loved that outlet. And I thought that sold a lot, didn't it, in a way? Because I think he needed to be very sure in his own boots.
So we had Piggin.
Here we go.
No, it's not a funny anecdote, but it did interest me. No, but I think it would be quite good on the record. Derek Jackson, the one conversation I had with him about Stan Rowe, because he sort of wrote the book on it, as far as I was concerned. I think that's pre-Cookies.
Who was?
Cookies.
Yeah.
I think it was the first on-screen Stan Rowe I could think of. And it was fascinating. And
Michael Palin in Fish Called Wanda. Sorry, just
there's
not remembering
them.
Yeah.
there's one thing where Cleese is trying to get some urgent.
Yes, absolutely.
But where did they go? Which direction?
Take your time.
Oh, come on!
Yes, exactly. It was that rupture.
But you see what I mean? You've got it. I mean, you know, that is an anecdote. We didn't know.
Hence the curfew, you know.
Listen, all I know,
Jacobi,
there's one great reference I had for a stammer in a person I'd met, and there was a wonderful production designer called Bruce McKay, who died some years ago.
Oh, no, you can't. I love this.
And I think Bruce was a beautiful example, because he's a highly intelligent man. And he hadn't cured his stammer, but he had put it to use somehow and use it for timing in some way.
Yes.
And I just remember him
saying, found his wit.
He'd seen some director naked once. The director had appeared naked in the film. And someone had said, have you been? And Bruce said, yes, and very unpleasant support. And something about the timing and the punctuation made everybody laugh. And I just remember thinking, that's wonderful. And he managed to make them sound like porters. Occasionally you have that glottal giveaway.
Right.
Fabulous. That was fucking awful.
Sorry, comic stammers. It was Peter Sellers. I'm all right, Jack. I can't remember the name of the actor. 1960 or something like that.
Yeah.
And they used that. Why don't you just tell them a photograph something worthwhile? Shut up, you stupid cock.
That's right. Yeah. I forget who that was.
I don't know who it was. It was a Peter Sellers film about union.
Yeah, it was
guys.
I'm all right, Jack.
Just came to my mind. Now, almost at the end, Jacobi, he talked about it, because his stammer was very different from mine. He can do this in him, impossible. And he said, they on the set of I, Claudius, they had this young guy who was one of the painters or assistant on the art department. He said he had a terrible stammer. And he said, that was very, very useful for me to work with, because I had a guy on the set, on the art department. And he said he was wonderful. He was called Bruce McKay. Same guy. And Derek's source was my source. When Derek had worked with him, he was just some young kid helping out with him. When I worked with him, he was a major production designer, but we both used the same guy. But come out with a completely different style.
We've also talked about how in my childhood, my uncle stammered, my cousin stammered. It's less and less prevalent.
Yeah.
And and I don't know whether it's that silent generation of those forefathers who went into that sort of disciplined area. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The shores of it. That kind of has left society a bit. There's a bit more openness, a bit more nurturing from on hand,
fantastic thing,
whatever.
Going on about it all day.
Willing enough to go, look, they're not mad, they're not abnormal,
so
they're five, and they've developed this manifestation of an
As I said, phenomenal movie. Just blew me away.
We have to wait till we get the scale right, because I haven't seen it.
I saw it right after I saw King's Speech, actually.
So I'm
in two best movies of the festival, right here.
Yeah?
Absolutely.
We know we're right.
I gotta let you guys go. Fantastic work.
I got that buzz this morning.
I just wanted to say, it's a great tandem piece, but it's also a great ensemble piece. It's worth mentioning.
Are you still here tomorrow?
It's a great
Monday.
Yes. Paul shows up.
I was sitting here last night. I
spent lunch.
Now
we actually sing it today.
The guys said,
one scene, two things.
So what do you want?
So completely. I mean, the two most difficult jobs in this film were Churchill, for obvious reasons, and Mrs. Simpson for different reasons. Because she's such an elephant in the room. I mean, we always talk about this film as being the B plot. We're making the B plot.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
And we're making the A plot.
Yeah.
So she is the main protagonist.
I stand at Common Garden Hotel, the front of house down the door.
And to have to show up in basically one scene and have us convinced
and
that you
and
have an entire life behind you and ahead of you without milking it, overemphasizing, trying to establish anything.
And that's true. All the stuff.
We have to make films. Now this woman is sort of even so relaxed. You could see a sense of humor. You could see her capriciousness. You could see a bit of humanity. There's a bit of vulnerability.
Right.
You know, you could see a bit of misfit. She's carrying that in those people. Same with the actress as Baldwin. The guy who plays Wood, one of my favourite voices in the film, the guy in charge of the radio recording, the gentlemanly, the young guy, Mr. Wood.
Yeah.
So civilised.
Like he's walking straight out of the 1930s.
Absolutely. Like David Niven.
Yeah, absolutely. Go eat your food, it's probably getting cold.
Thank you.